in Racine. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, The Morning Show with Greg Berg is next.
We welcome you to the Tuesday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. I am really excited to be connecting today on the program with a very talented young musician who also is doing something really extraordinary to try and help bring a bit of light into some of the more painful, hurting places in our world. His name is Davin Hallman. And he is someone who was born in Chicago, but grew up in Racine, now lives in Milwaukee, and is a very active musician who, among other things, is founder and music director of something called the Black String Triage Ensemble. And this is a group of musicians who make their way to the scenes of shootings and for sites of civil unrest of one kind or another, and at least attempt to keep the peace or restore the peace by playing music on site in the wake of something unfortunate or tragic that has unfolded. And Davin Hallman came to Carthage not terribly long ago to speak at chapel about the work that he and his fellow musicians do with the Black String Triage Ensemble. And I found myself so taken by the story and by what he had to say. And right then and there, I had to make sure to invite him to join me on the morning show to expand on what he talked about. Davin is also assistant conductor for Milwaukee's Concord Chamber Orchestra. And I'm very, very excited to speak with him about his inspiring work. Davin Hallman, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you. Good morning.
I'm really happy that we can have this conversation. Before we get into this intriguing story of the Black String Triage Ensemble, let's find out a little bit about your early life and your early life as a musician. First of all, you were born in Chicago, but actually grew up in Racine. Tell us what you think is most important for us to know about your childhood years and your entry into the world of music.
Oh, wow. My piano teacher, Janelle Thompson, I think I met her probably when I was about five, was spectacular and wonderful. I would give a huge shout out to the Racine public school system, who at least during the 1990s really seemed to have a wonderful, wonderful elementary school music program encompassing folk songs from countries around the world as well as America. And I think was really, really helpful to me. Sue Munson was my band director at a school that no longer exists, Stephen Bull Fine Arts. I think there's a string teacher around there who still does stuff, Charlene Meltzer, who's also equally wonderful. Al Clausen, legendary band director from Walden. Those folks, and many, 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 many others, really allowed me to grow and to do things and to try and to experiment. So I'm deeply, deeply grateful. Deeply grateful.
So were you growing up in a household where music was all around you? And was it just the most natural thing in the world for you to be devoting time and energy to it?
No, actually. It created quite a mess for the rest of the family. 'Cause nobody else played anything in my immediate family and to an extent my extended family. There's a story my mother tells when I was a toddler and my mom was trying to cook. And, you know, you give kids pots and pans to bang on. Well, she was cooking and I'm banging on pots and pans and she's reaching down, taking the pots I'm banging on so she can cook with them. My grandmother is in the other room. She can't see what's happening, but she can hear it. And she hollers at my mom. She says, "Stop that. He's got them in a specific order for a specific reason, and you're messing it up." That was when my mother says she knew her kid was different. And it probably wasn't too much longer after that. I mean, at that point, I probably was like 3. They eventually gave me an unsharpened No. 2 pencil to conduct the TV. when we moved to Reseda, my parents didn't want me doing music. I should say that up front. They did not want me doing music. But I think God, the universe, whoever or whatever it is that you believe in clearly had other ideas because the house they moved into was around the corner from the piano store. And we couldn't go to the grocery store. We couldn't go to church. We couldn't go to or from school without passing the piano store. And if anybody's got kids and, you know, they really, really, really want to do something, they will hound you until kingdom come. So I think my parents kind of somewhat relented, but they really didn't want me doing it. It wasn't until about 3 years ago, leading Black Diaspora Symphony Orchestra and walking out of the church after the concert, I looked at my mom and I said, "Now will you stop trying to tell me to do something else?" She wanted me to be a teacher. She wanted me to do anything and everything but.
One of the things I noted in your biography is that it listed not only violin and viola, which is primarily how I know you as a musician, but also saxophone, clarinet, and piano. So I'm just kind of interested in the way in which you ended up exploring all of those instruments, and for all I know, maybe more. And you know, just kind of how does that look in terms of it, doing all of that kind of exploration of various musical instruments?
It sounds really cool on the surface, but now that I'm older, I'll tell you, it's tough as nails. Oh my God. So I started on piano probably when I was about 4 or 5 years old. When we moved to Racine, my parents had me at Racine Montessori. And at that time, your kids had a choice. They could take violin or piano. I told them I wanted to do both. They said, "No, you have to choose." It ended up being piano. I still wanted violin very badly. Somewhere around the age of 9 or 10, when I was a student at Stephen Bull Fine Arts, I ended up wanting to play the saxophone. This question of where does the musical talent come from? My stepdad apparently had played saxophone. Not very long, not very well, but apparently he played. And I'm like, "Oh, I'll do that." So the school district had a rule. You take clarinet in the fall, we transition you to saxophone in the spring. By the time I was 13, my parents were in the process of getting a divorce. And as sometimes can happen, kids in divorces can sometimes twist their parents' arm and get things they wouldn't normally get. So at the age of 13, I got a violin. Go to the violin lesson. The teacher says, "Well, you started way too late. You'll never catch up. There's way too much music." You know, she wasn't completely discouraging, but she looked at me and said, "Go be a viola player. There's less music. There's less viola players in the world, and it's a much better instrument." And I didn't really want to. And she's like, yeah. "We'll put viola strings on your violin." Okay.
Wow.
And a relative gave me a recording of the Max Bruch Viola Concerto, the Viola Romance for Viola and Orchestra. and I heard it. And I'm like, oh my gosh, I can hear myself in this instrument. So then I was okay being a viola player.
Interesting. So I'm just curious. So if we take a glance at you, we might think you are a linebacker for the Cincinnati Bengals in terms of your physical stature. Can I assume that other things intruded on your life and energy as you were growing up, namely athletics, or was music kind of the sole focus of your energy and passion?
Music was really the sole focus of my energy and passion. I did baseball and tennis when I was in middle school and high school and enjoyed it greatly. I had always wanted to bodybuild, but I wasn't around the right type of guys in high school. So somewhere around the age of 29, I'm like, you know what? I'm going to start this. So that journey, you know, that non-musical journey is in its own adventure.
For those of you just joining us, I am speaking with Davin Hallman, who is founder and music director of the Black String Triage Ensemble, also associated with Milwaukee's Concord Chamber Orchestra and the Black Diaspora Symphony Orchestra. And we're going to be talking about some of those experiences that he has had as a musician. If I may, I wonder, as you were a young person growing up, a young African-American man growing up, did you ever feel out of place in this world of largely classical music?
That's hard to answer that. So yes and no. I was very fortunate in this way. My mother was heavily involved in the Church of God in Christ African-American Pentecostal denomination, founded in the early 1900s. And the denomination has a symphony orchestra. And they have about four big international meetings a year that last usually about a week at a stretch. And so my mom would go, and I'd go with her, and I'd find myself in a room, not just of other Black musicians, but Black composers, the people who are writing gospel music, who have Grammy Awards and Stellar Awards and so forth. So I think maybe in some ways I was somewhat sheltered away from some of the things other Black musicians in the classical music field have had to go through. But I also haven't had their opportunities, if that makes sense.
It does. Tell us about your schooling beyond high school.
Alvaro Garcia is a wonderful conductor and an excellent human being. I will say that because I joined Parkside Symphony when I was still in high school. Graduate of Racine Lutheran High School 2003. They did not have an orchestra. They only had a concert band. And when I show up, I think the concert band had 12 people in it.
Wow.
So to join an orchestra, I had to go to Parkside. I think it was Tuesday nights, Wednesday nights. I forget exactly. But I go, and it was just the greatest time. Everybody who I've played alongside in that ensemble over the years has been amazing, including Maestro Garcia himself. The way he talks to singers, the way he talks to musicians, his rehearsal process and technique, the energy and enthusiasm that he brings, it made it very easy for me to say, you know what, I want to be a Parkside student, because this is the guy who is being and doing exactly, he's where I want to go. I don't necessarily need a Curtis, a Juilliard, an Oberlin, or an Eastman, although those places are fantastic in and of themselves. If I can be who I want to be from somebody close to home, then I need to make that happen.
I'm glad that that's where you ended up. I very much admire Maestro Alvaro Garcia, and I can see how he would have been an absolutely ideal mentor for you. From the start, did you have aspirations to not only play, but also to conduct? I mean, to be the person on the podium waving the baton? I mean, or did that aspiration come much later?
Oh, no. I was like 4 or 5 years old, and I remember it very clearly. The first time I saw a full symphony orchestra on television. And just the way that everybody was dressed to the nines, the precision and control, it could be a sound as loud as the roar of the Concorde, which doesn't fly anymore, or as soft and gentle as the sneeze of a mosquito, and it can happen on the turn of a dime. I'm still impressed by that. The Kenosha Symphony asked the question a number of years ago. They said, why should people go to the symphony? And I sat there and I'm like, for the same reason that in the summer you stand out in a rainstorm and for the same reason that you go to the fireworks. You want to be immersed in an environment.
So you have made for yourself a rich and varied life as a musician, but have embarked now on something so striking and some would say, you know, an even revolutionary idea with the founding of this thing known as the Black String Triage Ensemble. Tell us first of all about the genesis of it. What was going on in Milwaukee and maybe in your life as well that led you to the realization that that music could somehow play a positive role in something so painful?
I'm glad you asked that question. It actually has nothing to do with Milwaukee and everything to do with Kenosha.
Ah.
I was a county board supervisor for 10 years between 2008 and 2018, representing the 7th District. If anybody who lives in Kenosha is listening, you know that towards the tail end of that, as we get to 2018, 2019, 2020, things start to get very interesting in the community. Interesting in some unpleasant ways, we'll just say. And I just felt like I loved being on county board. I loved being in public office to take care of people and to help make who you want to be manifest, right? But the hunger that I had for the community was bigger and deeper than what it wanted for itself. And I just got frustrated. I said, you know, this isn't working out. And I tried running for state assembly. I'm like, you know, I really think I just need to turn my attention more fully to music. I was music director at Grace Lutheran Church while being a county board supervisor, while working a job at Office Max. And I was walking through the district and something said to me, he said, what would happen if a bunch of string players showed up in the immediate aftermath of a shooting and didn't play Mozart? And I was like, I don't know. What would happen? Sometimes questions get placed in our spirit, like the dandelion seed that falls in your lawn that you didn't know about. And you wake up the next day, and all of a sudden, instead of one dandelion, you have 500. This was a bit like that. God, the universe, whomever, whatever, dropped the seed of the question, and it just took root and just grew.
Hmm. So tell us the first thing that you did. I mean, once there was the germination of this really intriguing idea, to whom did you turn? I mean, what were the very, very first steps in terms of creating what ultimately has become the Black String Triage Ensemble?
Well, the first steps, I was in the process of looking for a new job. And for whatever reason, I could not find one in Kenosha. I could not find one in Racine. I ended up actually in Waukesha working at a chiropractor's office, and then they went through some changes and fired me after about 5 or 6 months. First job I've ever been fired from. Thus far, the only one. And again, God, the universe said, well, you know, you're fired now, so you have all the time in the world to figure out what this looks like. Go get it done. And so I went Badger Care and food stamps. I went around Milwaukee. I went into barber shops, hair salons, laundromats, buses, churches, synagogues. I went all over just asking people, do you know anybody Black or Latin that plays violin, viola, cello, or upright bass? I posted stuff on Facebook. Like, I just got it out there, I had some connections with the Evangelical Lutheran Church here in Southeast Wisconsin. Checked around to see if there was a congregation that would be willing to have a few string players in their building for rehearsal. And then January of 2019, had the first rehearsal, had no clue who was going to walk in the door, if anybody, and four or five people that I've never met before until that moment walked in and said, so what are we doing? They came in with their instrument cases, and I'm like, well, here's the plan. And they're like, all right, let's see what happens.
Wow. So just for a point of clarification, so as you had issued this invitation, was it attached to sort of your dream for this group in terms of what it would do, where it would play, and that sort of thing? Or did they learn when they arrived that night just what this was all about?
I don't remember in whatever promotional materials I put together, I don't remember what it said. I'm sure I have it printed sitting in a box somewhere. But I know I told people when they walked in the room, I said, here's the plan. Mind you, I had no idea how any of it was going to work, right?
Well, and I was thinking, I mean, essentially is something, as far as I know, is just not ever been done before. This idea of putting together a string group that's going to show up someplace where perhaps a tragic shooting has occurred and will go to that location and begin playing. I mean, I'm not sure there's even a way to succinctly describe that and for people reading it to necessarily even make sense of it. I mean, I guess that's part of what's difficult and also incredibly exciting about a truly groundbreaking idea.
Well, so I guess I should say this too, and it's the way you describe it. Yes, it is new and it is groundbreaking, but it's still tethered to other things. You know, you and I both know it's not uncommon in Europe if a church or a school is bombed, the next day somebody's going to show up with a cello. Right?
Yes.
That's not uncommon. But the issue of gun violence in America and having musicians that are first responders to people's spirits who have to see that, hear that, and deal with that and all of its various manifestations in terms of how it affects people, yeah, that's new. Nobody's doing that. In fact, I'll tell you this. You can get money in Chicago, in the city of Chicago. You can get money to hold concerts in a neighborhood as a means of violence prevention. But there is nobody showing up to the scene in the immediate aftermath trying to help heal the people.
Hmm.
Nobody's thought of it.
Right. So when it came time to begin to actually do this, so we're talking now about beyond the first few rehearsals, what was involved in terms of sort of, if you will, sort of creating or shaping or preparing for the first opportunity that you and your fellow musicians would have to play in this way?
I would say the biggest thing is the mental part. You know, the music stuff, we're all accustomed to doing. We're accustomed to practicing, you know, the fingerings, the harmony, like all the stuff you need to execute musically. That's not the challenge. The challenge is the mental part, because we have no idea what state emotionally people are going to be in, whether that's folks in the neighborhood or law enforcement, right? And the challenge for us is, how do we be present? How do we be present but not give added weight, right? How do we be present as a neutral entity but then use the music to uplift? Because you can show up in a space and add weight and drag down, and that's not what we want. We don't want to have a weighty impact. We want to have an uplifting impact. But when we show up, our presence, simply by showing up, our presence should not alter the space. let the music do the work as much as possible. And that's all mental work.
Right. So explain what happens that when... And we should also mention that this is largely done during the summer months, if I understand correctly. So tell us from, in a sense, start to finish, what typically happens in one of these occurrences in which gun violence has broken out. I mean, describe this to us from the moment that one way or another you are notified.
So there is no one that notifies us. I tried to set that up from the get-go. The police department was not enthused about this. I'll just say it like that. They are now, but they weren't at the beginning. So on a typical night, we'll say it's a Friday night in June, July, or August. It's 6 o'clock where we, as the Black String Triage Ensemble, are all sitting together in a space. We might be playing a card game of Uno and eating some food. Folks have tuned their instruments. You know, the bag of music and the music stands are by the door ready to go. We figured out who's jumping into whose car, because transportation for us is actually quite a struggle. Sometimes we don't have enough cars to transport everybody. And then when that happens, then we have to actually cancel what I call being on call. But let's say we got enough vehicles. And I watched the City of Milwaukee 911 call log. It was maybe about two or three police chiefs ago that police chief decided that there were too many shootings in Milwaukee, and so he didn't want police calls on a public channel. They're the only 911 entity that's not on a public channel. However, all of the 911 calls that come in are briefly cataloged on a city website. But it's only based off of what somebody calls in. So we're sitting around playing cards, eating food, and call log, it says, shooting, and it says the address. And I'll look at everybody, and I'll kind of go, okay, well, something came up, and it says shooting. And I'll tell them where it's at, and I'll say, well, it looks like it's been posted for about 30 minutes. So that means it actually might be a situation. So we all pack our stuff up, get in the cars. We usually have a chaplain with us, at least one. We try to. The chaplain has full authority to talk to people at the scene. We get to the scene. We get out. First thing I look for is anybody grieving? Is anybody crying? Because that person does not need or want a violin or cello near their face. Mm. So I look for that. Is anybody grieving or crying? Where is the police tape? Where did the actual whatever occur? And once I get a fix on that, okay, so are there people on the street? Is there law enforcement? How many? Are there windows open? Are there people looking out of windows? Okay, where can we position ourselves as string players to be heard because there's no acoustical shell? So if you can bounce the sound off of a building or something, that's really helpful. And then it's about, okay, well, we figured out space-wise, physically, where we should be at the scene. All right, we're going to go set up over there. All right, so we set up, and once we've done that, you know, put the music stands up, put the music on it. It's like, okay, everybody, how do we feel? Like, do we feel like we should play now? Do we feel like we need to wait? If we've got a chaplain with us, you know, the chaplain probably will have talked to a couple people in the neighborhood. They might have had a conversation or two with somebody from law enforcement. And we don't need to know what happened. We don't need to know who got shot. We don't need to know if they lived or they died, if they're a man, woman, child, like none of that. Chaplains can have all those details. As far as us as musicians, it's chaplains help give our presence context and keep people from coming up to us asking us questions. What are you about to do? What are you about to play? Oh, I want to sing a song. No, we're not. We're not prepared to have you be Whitney Houston right now. I'm very sorry. And so, you know, sometimes the chaplains will be like, well, you know, it happened about 30, 40 minutes ago. You know, they can give us insight as to where people are at emotionally so we know not only if we should play, but also what, right? Because there's, the way I set it up, there's two sets of music. There's an A program and a B program, just for difference of musical use. One is not better than the other. One is not subservient to the other. It's just a matter of choices. And each of them is six songs, the five stages of grief, with the last stage of faith included at the end. Because if we as humans don't think it's going to get better, we don't move forward. It isn't so much a religious question. It can be, but it isn't. That isn't always the case for everyone.
Right. So I'm just, so, I want just a clarification there. So with each of these programs, Program A and Program B, you're playing a series of pieces of music that, in at least in some sense, can take the listener through those stages of grief or reflect those various stages of grief. Is that what you're saying?
Exactly. Ah. Exactly. And it is not classical. We are playing Black and Latin composers, and out of those six different pieces of music, you might have one that's classical. You might have none. You might have one piece that's reggae. You might have one piece that's jazz. You might have one piece that's blues or gospel or tango. So I'm trying to think of examples. We've used Deep River to represent denial. We have used a bit of a Florence Beatrice Price string quartet to represent anger. We've used Marvin Gaye, What's Going On, for acceptance, right? We've used Richard Smallwood's Total Praise to represent faith. So it's just been a variety. We've used Duke Ellington's, and now I'm blanking on the title of it, but we've used that to represent tension. So it's there's a lot that we've done,
yeah.
in terms of music. But just because you have those six songs doesn't mean you're going to start right at denial. That may not be where people are at when you show up to a crime scene. They might be somewhere else. So it's also about feeling where they are, and then musically, what do you have out of those two different sets of six songs that meets them where they are? I'll give a real quick example if I can. Mm-hmm. There was a crime scene that we played about 2 or 3 years ago, and I believe what had happened is man was driving his car, was shot while he was driving and crashed into a tree or a building. We showed up not too long after it had happened. The medical examiner hadn't even showed up yet. By the time we had set up and were ready to play, the medical examiner's car rolled up. And I looked at everybody. I said, don't play. Don't play yet. And man comes out of nowhere, sees what's happened, starts cussing and hollering, on God, that's my friend. We don't even live here. I can't believe this happened. And that went on for a while, and then somebody escorted him away from the scene, and I looked at Black String Triage. As soon as he was away from the scene, I said, now. And we started in on Sometimes I Feel Like a Motherless Child to represent denial. But we skipped a number of other things on the program because I noticed that as we were playing, people had started to gather. It started to form a circle and put arms around one another. So in that kind of situation, I said, okay, skip the other stuff. Go straight to Total Praise. Lord, I will lift mine eyes to the hills from which comes my help. Is the lyrics for Total Praise. So it seemed to be where people were in that moment. Speak to the moment.
Yeah. One question I have is, was it a very conscious decision on your part to make this a group of specifically string players? Because, of course, you could have, and I guess I'm assuming that, I mean, it's in the name, and what I have seen of what you do, it is string players. Is there something particular about string instruments beyond the fact that that's probably where your own musical expertise is most firmly rooted or anchored, but is there something about string instruments that you think make them an especially apt choice for this kind of experience to be played in these kind of situations?
Yes, and I want to quote, I believe it's Norman Del Mar's Anatomy of the Orchestra. So the strings are the instrument that is the closest to the human voice. They are the instrument that is the most musically and emotionally nimble in terms of producing sounds and colors. If you want to double the sound of a string instrument, you have to multiply by two versus a woodwind or brass where you literally just add one. So in terms of having something that is nimble and sensitive, but that can that can reach you directly, can grab right into your heart where you are, I think it was necessary for it to be string players. I think in terms of, I'll just say this, in terms of Wisconsin, we don't see Black and Latin folks playing stringed instruments every day. You know, and I know that there's like hip-hop violin and hip-hop cello and stuff like that. That's out there, but let's be real. It's not abundant. Everybody is not doing this. And so the population in Milwaukee is 60-70% Black and Latin. I wanted people to be able to see themselves in who shows up holding an instrument that folks don't normally see every day. You know, there's still a lot of people of color that don't know and don't think that a string instrument is part of our history. This idea in America that folks on the plantation were the ones with violins, violas, cellos, and basses providing the music is something that everyone in this country has buried and deliberately forgotten.
Very good point.
And unfortunately, those of us who are folks of African descent have allowed that to happen. Even so that the vast majority of us as Black Americans don't even know that's part of our history.
Right. When you came to Carthage to speak at chapel and then led a program after that, which included at least one member of the Black String Triage Ensemble, they screened for us a short documentary. I mean, my recollection is it was maybe, I don't know, 10 or 15 minutes long about the Black String Triage Ensemble. One of the most striking moments in that little documentary was where we, I don't remember if we saw it, but I know we heard a little bit of audio in which it was clearly a situation in which perhaps your presence at the site of a shooting was not particularly welcome. I mean, we hear the voices of somebody who seems maybe a little bit angry or bewildered about, you know, what you're doing. And I appreciated that being included in the mix in this little documentary film because it reminded us that, you know, in a sense, you and your fellow musicians are taking a chance in stepping into these situations that are almost always, to some extent, highly charged and maybe a bit unpredictable and so on. Can you just talk for a moment about those instances when you come and the people who happen to be within earshot of your playing are maybe not immediately receptive or not maybe understanding what you're doing is all about?
Yeah. So I guess I'll preface it by saying when we have a chaplain present, that does not happen. Which is one of the reasons why we always try to make sure that we have a chaplain when we go out. Sometimes we're not, you know, sometimes there isn't a rev available to go with us. And so in those cases, which I think is what's shown in the 11 and a half minute documentary short called Black Strings, produced and directed by Marquise Mays, fantastic filmmaker. So we, in that case, I believe we showed up and there was a lady who really, really wanted us to play. But the people, I want to say they were like in a house on a upper porch. They weren't arguing with us. They were arguing with her. And I think they were struggling to process what was happening and viewed our presence as a distraction from them processing. Because she starts arguing with them. No, I want to hear the music. And they're like, your so-and-so just got killed. Are you kidding me? What do you mean you want to hear music?
Hmm.
A chaplain present can deal with all of that so we can just work. Because sometimes people want prayer. Sometimes they just want to talk. You know, it can be a whole range of stuff.
So what is the effect that you most want your music to have in these moments for the people who are listening to you? I mean, or is that, in a sense, too restrictive a question? I mean, is what you are trying to accomplish much more open-ended than a particular goal?
No, oh no, there's definitely a very specific goal. The challenge is, you know, who is on the receiving end of that goal. We don't always know. The goal is to show up and to use the music as a tool to provide healing and hope for people in the immediate aftermath of tragic circumstances. You know, nobody should go to bed with the shooting that occurred outside their house on their mind. You shouldn't have to go to bed with it. Your husband, wife shouldn't have to go to bed with it. Your kids shouldn't have to go to bed with it. Because if you go to bed with it, then you wake up with it. If we don't stop the seed from the trauma, if we do not stop it from taking root, it will play over and over and over and over in your mind. You can be at a salad bar in a restaurant, 2-3 months away from the incident. But because somebody dropped a plate, you blink your eyes and all of a sudden it plays back to what you saw and heard 2-3 months ago. If we can use music to extract that so that that does not occur, if we can stop the elevator from falling down the shaft, if we can catch the tears before they hit the floor, we've done our job. Hmm. And 9 times out of 10, the feedback I get is exactly that. And I continue to be humbled, amazed, blessed, and surprised that this works for people.
Hmm.
I knew it would, but the extent of it continues to amaze me.
Yeah. So are you, in a sense, in rehearsal now for this upcoming next season of the Black String Triage Ensemble? I mean, when you will, in a sense, go back to work playing for these situations?
Yes. The short answer is yes.
And I wonder if there are things that people in the community can do who are hearing about this and thinking that one way or another they would like to support the work that you're doing. I mean, is it work that requires support or would benefit from support of the community?
Absolutely. So if people wanted to support, here are 3 ways that you can support. One, if you have a good-sized passenger van that you're not using or looking to offload, we could definitely use that because right now we're carpooling and not everybody who has an instrument has a car. So that's one. 2, if you are a string player, violin, viola, cello, upright, bass, and you are an adult, there is a sister string orchestra that assists Black String Triage. It's called Legion of the Soul. You don't have to be Black or Latin to do this. Join Legion of the Soul. Help us out. It's part of the organization of Black String Triage. 3rd thing I'd say, if you don't have a passenger van you're looking to offload and you don't play a string instrument and you don't know anybody who does, you can always give $5, $10, $50, $100. It helps us out. The musicians, you know, the first year or two we could be kind of volunteer. We can't get away with that anymore. So it's not a lot of money, but I mean, it'll be like $50 sitting around for 5 or 6 hours in case a shooting happens. Mm-hmm. You know, for musicians, I mean, you know, the wedding gig might be $400 or $500. The mariachi gig might be $300 or $400. The club gig might be, you know, $300 or $400. So to try to have trained, skilled musicians be available during what we might consider peak weekend work hours is a challenge.
Right. And if people do want to make financial contributions, how do they do that?
Go to the Black String Triage Ensemble.org. In fact, if you type in Black String Triage into your browser, you'll get a whole bunch of videos. There's Black String Triage and Legion in Kenosha 2 days before Kyle Rittenhouse. There's Black String Triage and Legion, I think, in Wauwatosa. There's videos of Black Diaspora Symphony. There's the 11.5-minute Black Strings PBS documentary that you saw, as well as a NBC National News piece from about, I want to say it's August of about 2 years ago. Mm. So there's a bunch of stuff. But go on the website. Feel free to donate.
Very good.
Definitely. Definitely make use of it.
Dave and Hallman, founder and music director of the Black String Triage Ensemble. David, it's been just great to talk with you, to hear more about this really incredible and inspiring story. And I thank you for making time in your schedule to be part of the morning show today. I was honored to speak with you, and I wish you very, very well in all of your future endeavors, musical and otherwise.
Thank you, Professor. It's been an honor to have the conversation. Thank you.
Tomorrow on the morning show, we'll be spending part of the hour with Nathan Stamper, who is responsible for directing the current production at the Racine Theater Guild of a really interesting coming-of-age story called Stargirl. I saw it the other night and very, very much enjoyed it. And I look forward to speaking with Nathan Stamper Actually, it's Thursday's morning show as I look a little closer at the calendar. Tomorrow on the morning show, you'll hear my interview with Nathaniel Fanning, who has written a book called Creativity Unleashed, a book which looks at the very nature of creativity, what it is, how it affects our lives, what we can do to foster it. And on Friday's morning show, I speak with a really gifted writer by the name of David Coggan, who has written yet another memoir about one of the great loves of his life, fly fishing. An earlier book is called The Optimist. This latest book is called The Believer. And in the course of this book, We, in a sense, follow David Coggan as he travels the world to engage in fly fishing in some truly beautiful and remarkable places all around the globe. That's on Friday's morning show. The morning show.